So in the first 4 days of this 5-week class, I talked to use the analogy of a pyramid to describe the Buddhist path and the Buddhist life. That in the teachings of the Buddha, the Buddhist life is one that is developmental, follows kind of a developmental model, much in the way that a child develops developmentally. We'd expect a child to develop over time. And just because you become an adult doesn't mean you need to stop developing. But there can be further development, and that the spiritual life is in a kind of continuation of our maturation. Sometimes I think of it just kind of, you know, further maturation of the human being. It's not particularly Buddhist or religious. It's just a deepening, a further process of maturation. So I talked about the pyramid, and the pyramid needs to have a good foundation. And with a good foundation, you can get pretty high in the pyramid. But if you don't have that foundation, the pyramid could kind of, or there's, you know, just a pole standing up, it can tip over pretty easily. Today I'd like to offer you a different analogy for the path, the Buddhist path or the Buddhist life. And that is the growth of a flower, the growth of a plant. You know, first you have to plant a seed, and then you tend to that seed, you nourish it, you water it and give it nutrients, and protect it from bugs and gophers or whatever. And then the seed sprouts and it grows, and you also protect it from yourself, because if you come and pull it out of the ground to look how well it's growing, you probably can't get it back in again to grow. And so you just kind of leave it there. You're very patient. You kind of nurture it along. You support it to grow. You can't be greedy about the growth of plants. You can't be lackadaisical. You have to kind of offer them some care, but you can't just let them grow in their own time. And then as the plant grows, it gets taller and bigger, and at some point there's a flower bud that appears on the plant. And if you pick that bud off, that bud will never become a flower. So you need to know to leave that bud alone and let it kind of blossom into the beautiful flower. You could pick the flower then, but if you pick the flower, then the flower will never have a chance to become a fruit. And so you leave the flower there so the flower can continue, the plant can continue to develop. And a fruit or a seed or something, the fruit grows then on that plant. Say it's an apple. There's an apple flower, and then the apple begins growing. And if the apple is really green and small, and you pick it and try to eat it, you get something that's kind of, you know, what's the word for unripe apples? What? Tart? Sour? Tart? And so you leave the apple there, and one way to know when an apple is really ripe is you come gently and take your hand underneath the apple and very gently kind of lift it up. And if it just comes off in your hand, you know it's ripe. But if you have to pull on it, it's not quite ripe yet. And so at some point, the apple just, you know, comes free quite easily, almost naturally by itself, or the wind blows or something happens, it just falls at some point. It just falls by itself, gets released from the plant. The goal of the Buddhist life is sometimes called the fruit. They actually use the word fruit, phala, in Pali. And so after building the pyramid, after building the plant and letting it grow, following this organic process, at some point there's a maturation process that occurs that is not exactly in your control. I can't control my 6-year-old son's maturation process so well. If I try to hurry it up like I do sometimes, it's just a disaster. But if I just be patient and nourish it along, it seems to come along just fine on its own. You know, I'm just impatient as a father, right? So, but our own spiritual development is the same way, that we have to do something to support and nurture it and guide it. But also there's a way of kind of just also being patient and allowing some development to happen on its own. And the ultimate, the highest goals of Buddhism are like a fruit, that you don't want to pick the flower, but you want to encourage the plant to keep growing. You don't want to pick the fruit too early, but you want to wait until a point where the fruit or the apple is ready to fall off by itself, or falls off by itself, it releases itself. But that experience of release, of letting go, is the ultimate kind of point or step in Buddhist practice, to have a very profound and full experience of release or letting go, relinquishment. And the apple just drops, so we just drop, or we, you know, all the things that are, you know, when we're really ripe, then we can let go. And the most common way that the Buddha talked about the ultimate kind of goal of the spiritual life is in language that's akin to language of letting go. The word for nibbana, which is the Pali word for nirvana, is probably best translated into English as release. It's an experience of release. The apple releases itself from the tree. The fruit releases itself. There's a release within us, a kind of release, when we're mature, when things are ripe. And I say this, I use this analogy of the plant, because it implies that the release happens, should only happen when things are really mature and ready for it. The letting go is meant to be happen when you're ready to let go. People hear that the letting go is a very important part of Buddhist practice, sometimes are troubled by that, because what am I supposed to let go of, man? Let go of all these things, you know, my job or my family and all these things, you know, what does that mean, let go? And or people do let go, and they let go of things too early. The idea, I think, is to really let go or allow release to happen when the maturity is there, the ripeness is there, that it's the appropriate thing to happen on its own. You don't have to rush it and force it. Some things we learn to let go of or ready to let go of earlier than other things. Some things are only let go of when practice is quite deep and strong. So the path of cultivation, which we talked about last week, is partly kind of what allows that plant to grow and strengthen. First you have to have a strong stalk or a strong trunk or a branch or whatever the plant is, so that it can hold the flower and the fruit. And so you need to have that in place so that it supports the growth of that that fruit. And if the stalk or the branch is not strong enough, then it's not going to carry the weight of the fruit as it matures, and then the branch will break. So we need to have the cultivation part, developing ourselves, as an important part of Buddhist practice. But from the point of view of the ultimate goal of Buddhism, it's all eventually to support our capacity to let go, to release. Now imagine yourself waking up from a wonderful nap, you had a nice meal, you feel wonderful things have happened to you for the last week, you feel quite content and satisfied with many things, and you go out into your street where your car is parked, and just look at the sky. It feels so wonderful. It seems like a perfect moment, and everything's just nice and wonderful and calm. And then you look down at your tire and see you have a flat tire. How do you respond? You probably respond differently at that time when you feel quite relaxed and open and confident in yourself than if you feel insecure, lack of confidence, frazzled, harried, late for appointments, and you rush out and everything's going wrong, and you look at that flat tire and just, ugh! You know, you feel really good about stuff, and you live a life that's wise and not late for everything. You see that flat tire and you go, oh, that's too bad. I think today I can take the bus. You know, just let go of it. So, you know, it's easier to let go when we have a certain state of mind or a certain state of being. There's a point I'm trying to make here. And certain things that are quite reasonable to let go of are hard to let go of when we're in difficult states of mind. Our ability to let go is dependent on a lot of different conditions. Our own sense of inner well-being and inner strength, circumstances around us, what's going on. It has a lot to do with our ability, how we see the world, our perspective and understanding of what the world's about. So, for example, if someone doesn't show up for an appointment that they promised they'd show up for, you could, of course, get very angry. How could that person be such a jerk? And you could spend a lot of time holding on to your anger to that person and your planning, what you're going to tell that person, whatever, right? But you get a phone call and find out the person was going to be there on time but had an accident and now in the hospital. And that perspective, suddenly, you know, at that moment you can let go of your holding. And because you have a new perspective, what's going on? Some people, when they get offended by someone who's being kind of obnoxious, have the capacity to look at that obnoxious person, that difficult person, and see the suffering in that person's heart that's stimulating their obnoxious behavior. And seeing that suffering changes the perspective that you can let go of taking offense or wanting revenge or something. It kind of changes kind of the way we hold that situation. On Monday, I heard a story of a senior high school student, a girl who went to the prom with a guy. And the guy went home at the end of the prom with a different girl, different woman. So that's pretty bad, isn't it? I think that's bad. It's not polite. And so she went home and she was miserable. And which is maybe to expected. And she was miserable for 2 weeks, pouting and miserable and feeling really terrible about being jilted at the prom. And then her grandmother came up to her and said, "What would it take for you to let go of your pain? What would it cost? What would I have to pay you?" And she said, $50 and a new pair of shoes. So the grandmother gave her the $50 and took her out and bought her new pairs of shoes. And that was it. But then, the grandmother, this is the wise part of the story, the grandmother turned to the granddaughter and said, "You did that. You were the one who let go. You chose to let go when you made this equation in your mind that this was, you were holding on. It was your choice to hold on to that pain. And it was your choice to let go. I bribed you." But it was still your choice. The possibility of letting go is something that's inherent in in life. Whenever there's holding on, there's a possibility of letting go. And a lot of Buddhist spirituality emphasizes letting go, letting go. The great Thai meditation teacher named Ajahn Chah said, if you let go a little, you'll have a little happiness. And if you let go a lot, you'll have a lot of happiness. You'll have great happiness. And if you let go a little, you have a little happiness. If you let go a lot, you'll have a lot of happiness. If you let go completely, you'll have a great happiness. So the idea of letting go. What do people hold on to? We hold on to a lot. It doesn't take a lot of analysis or figuring or reflection to realize we hold on to things. If we are living with a lot of regret, we're holding on to the past in some way. If we're spending a lot of time planning, we're holding on to the future. If we're living our life through fear of, of all kinds of things, that fear is a kind of holding on to certain ideas or anticipations or imaginations of what might happen. We hold on to our sense of self, our sense of dignity, or our sense of worth, or who we need to be, or our identity. And, as a story I like to tell, silly little analogy of, if you go up into the Sierras to go backpacking, after a few days you forget everything about a lot of things about your regular life, and things in your regular life that would really have bugged you, this doesn't really affect you so much. Everything's get left behind. And you have you're up there camping and you spill ketchup on your shirt. It's not a big deal. But you come back here and you spill ketchup on your, your nice shirt at your, before your business meeting. You're horrified. Or you have a business lunch with someone. It's like, it's bad, but it's like it impacts on how they see you and how you think you are and how you're seen and all these ideas of self and relationship to other people. And we can hold on to that and it can grip us really strongly. Why in some situations do we let go and other situations do we hold on to? What are we holding on to in certain situations? Part of the reason to cultivate mindfulness and concentration is so that we can actually begin penetrating under the surface of what we're holding on to. It could be, to make up kind of a scenario, that we're holding on to having a clean shirt because we're afraid of losing our job. And we're afraid of losing our job because we're afraid of being homeless. And we're afraid of being homeless because we're afraid to die. But if a person has no fear of death, maybe there's no fear of homelessness. There's no fear of homelessness, there's no fear of losing a job. There's no fear of losing a job, there's no fear of ketchup in the shirt. And you can go into the board meeting relaxed. I mean, that's a silly, bad analogy, but you have to fill in the blanks for yourself. The way in which sometimes there's very deep-seated ways things we're holding on to, which is the foundation for something we're doing kind of 3 or 4 or 10 generations away from that deep holding. Holding on to a sense of self in Buddhism is considered one of the more pernicious and deepest kind of holdings we have. And we can let go of that too. It's possible to let go of that. You'll forgive me if I tell you a joke. It kind of points to this. Of a man who worked for a company and director of the board or something. And he had to make periodically he had to make presentations to the board. And he was very nervous about this. And whenever he made a presentation to the board, he pissed in his pants, which was not a good thing. It's worse than ketchup. And so the CEO of the company came up to him and she said, you know, I think you need to work on this. We're going to send you to the psychotherapist, the company therapist, and work on this. And a few weeks later, he comes back and says, I'm cured. She said, oh, great. So you no longer piss in your pants? And he said, oh, no, no. I still piss in my pants, but I no longer care. So I don't know if that's wise letting go, but... someone once said, forgiveness is giving up all hope for a better past. So the point, you know, this idea of letting go. What do we hold on to? Now, this whole idea of the developmental model, the pyramid and the plant, is suggesting that letting go is not easy. Though some things might be quite easy. But, you know, it's not always so easy. And so it's best done when it's really clear that this is a useful thing to let go of. If you just have a blanket policy, let go, let go, let go, it might not be so wise for you. It might be much wiser to kind of live your life, practice as deeply and sincerely as you can, and when it becomes really clear, this is not serving me anymore. This is causing me harm. I'm holding on to this grudge, and the person that I have a grudge against has long since forgotten even who I am, let alone the incident. And I'm still being harmed by what that person did. Why, you know, why do I hold on to this? It's harming me more than them. Wanting revenge, being furious and filled with revenge, causes harm to ourselves. We realize the harm we're causing ourselves in being, you know, filled with angry desires for revenge. It's a lot easier to let go of the anger than it is if you don't see the harm it's causing for yourself. To hold on to all kinds of things. If you really see, once you see the cost that it has on you, it's easier to let go of. Maybe then that's when the fruit has ripened and okay, you let it just fall off easily. Part of the function of mindfulness and concentration, seeing deeply, is to develop the kind of sensitivity that allows us to see the cost that the cost on us, the effect it has on us and the environment, to be holding on to things, to be attached, to be clinging. And I think it becomes a whole different, it's not a moralistic thing, you should let go of your clinging, your attachments, but rather when you have the sensitivity to see, oh yeah, this is a drag, clinging to this. Isn't there a better way to live? Isn't there a wiser way to live? Also, because it's letting go can be very challenging. The really deep letting go of a deep spiritual life can often arouse a certain level of fear. Because we're so used to orienting ourselves and seeing ourselves, understanding ourselves in particular ways, and we have to let go of that. It's kind of like, well, then I'm not, you know, safe. It's not, you know, some people, you know, just they always see themselves in certain ways, they hold themselves in certain ways, and you know, I have to be tough, or I have to be smart, or I have to be kind, or I have to be wounded, or I have to be subservient, or I have to be a follower, or I have to be a leader, or, you know, all these things we think we have to be, and we hold on to it. And sometimes we get quite brittle because we're holding on to it. And it doesn't have to be that way at all. We don't have to be anything, hold on to any kind of beingness. We can just be who we are without needing to become something, hold on to something, or defend anything of who we are. But it can be quite frightening to do that. And part of the reason to have this pyramid approach to spiritual practice is it's a lot easier to let go when there's a sense of well-being inside. So if you know through the earlier parts of the path how to cultivate a sense of well-being, kind of happiness, to learn how to be happy with your ethical life, it actually makes you happy. It was really strange when I went to Thailand that people were happy that they were ethical. That was a foreign idea growing up in America for me. I mean, that those kinds of people were goody-goodies. You know, that was kind of like not so desirable to be that kind of person, you know. Even though I was kind of an ethical person, I never thought it was a virtue or whatever. But the idea that you'd be happy because of it. But in traditional Buddhism, people actually feel happy. They avail themselves, they allow themselves to feel happy because they know that they are living a blameless life with that part of their life which is blameless. Living ethical, virtue. Allow yourself to have the happiness of knowing that you're generous, that you do good things in your community. That's considered a really healthy thing in Buddhism, to avail yourself, to allow yourself to feel happiness. And to cultivate that kind of happiness, feeling good. My wife this today left. Some friends of ours don't have a lot of money, but they like coffee, and they go to Costco for coffee, but they let on that they really like Pete's coffee. So she was near Pete's someplace, and she was near their house also. Near each other. She bought a pound of Pete's coffee and left it on their doorstep. Later in the day, she got a phone call thanking them, and she said, "Oh, just this morning, my wife said, I'm so tired of Costco coffee." And, you know, and then my wife said something like, "Yeah, I just wanted to express how much I love you, the two of you, how much I appreciate the two of you." And they said, "Yeah, and we really love you, appreciate you." So that made her happy, made me happy, just hearing the story. And so that wasn't this, you know, difficult way of getting some little teeny bit of happiness in your life, you know. But Buddhism encourages you to do those kinds of things for that happiness that comes, a sense of well-being that can come from that. It can be long-lasting, that kind of happiness. And then the happiness of developing healthy relationships, healthy loving relationship, developing loving kindness or kindness. It's a kind of a happiness to know that I'm basically, in most situations I come into, I'm basically can meet that situation with some level of kindness. That could make a person happy to know that they have that ability. I can't do it all the time, but so to feel happy about that, even though the rest of your life is miserable. You know, to feel happy, start cultivating happiness. Happiness is not left to chance in Buddhism, but it's something that you can actually develop and work on and have some say in it. Buy someone Pete's coffee and leave it on the doorstep. See what happens if you do that. And then there's the well-being that comes from meditation practice, cultivating mindfulness, concentration, meditation. Seeing if you can use meditation to cultivate a sense of well-being, a sense of being at home in yourself, calm, collected, letting go of some of the things that keep you from kind of being settled. And so you're developing a sense of well-being as a resource within you. So that when you come up in the edge of practice, you have to let go of something really scary. You have this support behind you, the strength within you, that maybe you're willing to take a chance. I can let go of needing to be anybody in this situation. I don't have to prove myself. I don't have to defend myself. I can just be here transparent and open. It's okay for people to see who I am. Amazing. So letting go is... the word, as I said, in Buddhism is release. And release is a beautiful word. I've been told that in AA, they also use the word release. And their release is understood to be a gift. It's not something that you can do yourself. It's something. It's a kind of feeling of something that's done for you. And some of the deepest forms of release in Buddhism is not something that you have control over, but rather you set the conditions up so that something else releases, something else does the releasing. But some of that is see clearly. The truth will set you free is the common expression. I think it works really well for Buddhism also. That if you really see very honestly and fully what's here, that often that's when the release can happen. So release is a very important part of Buddhism. And it's a description of absence. It's a description of the absence of clinging and holding. But that doesn't mean that it's kind of dull or empty. Or boring. When all the ways in which we are uptight, holding on, afraid, resistant, all the ways that we cling to things, all these ways fall apart, and the heart is no longer busy, the mind is not busy doing all these things, what happens to the heart and the mind is that it becomes luminous and radiant. There's a kind of a beauty, a luminosity, a level of peace and happiness. It's as if it's inherent in the heart itself. And it's almost like covered over by all these things. And as we let go, this phenomenal sense of peace and happiness that's there is possible. It surfaces or shows itself. The question, the challenge for people interested in the Buddhist path is how seriously are we going to take that possibility? If you take it 20% seriously, then you can take the path maybe 20% of the way and get all the benefits. Remember, in the first class I said, the Buddhist path is good in the beginning, good in the middle, and good in the end. Even one moment of mindfulness is good. So, you don't have to kind of be goal-oriented, some distant goal. In some way, the goal is fulfilled in each moment you practice. But if you're 20% are motivated by that goal, the ultimate goal, then 20% you'll get there, 20% of the way. But if you really understand and really inspired by this possibility, and you see that the possibility of letting go of every single little clinging, holding on in your psyche is a worthwhile thing to do, then some people get deeply, deeply motivated to do the work it takes to have that release, to let that happen. It takes a fair amount of endeavoring and engagement. It takes a certain amount of seriousness of purpose, of intent. This is really important. It's more important for me to experience release, to discover this possibility, than it is to watch Buffy the Vampire, which I've never watched. or whatever, So release is the culmination of the Buddhist path. One of the profound expressions of it, which is very confusing for a lot of people in the West, is the idea of not-self, of kind of letting go of clinging to self, realizing that the aspect of not-selfness. Because we hold on to the self so much, and it's very frightening, this idea of, well, I have to have a self, and I can't let go of my sense of self and who I think I am and all these things. But the suggestion in Buddhism is that you actually be a lot better off if you let go of that. Do you believe it? If you don't believe it, that's good. If you don't believe it, that's the place where you don't believe it, where you struggle, where you have doubts, is actually usually a very, very good place for practice to occur, to explore, to deepen, to question, to practice in that area of discomfort. The more uncomfortable you are, the more there's probably something there to be seen. No one's asking you to let go before the fruit is ready. So that's okay. Just wait in your own time. Your fruit will be ready. And the final thing I'll say before I take questions is as a kind of when the apple drops from the tree by itself, at some point the heart releases itself. At some point the mind, consciousness, releases itself. It's almost as if consciousness itself is a kind of a holding, kind of a clinging. And when the consciousness lets go of itself, that's touching what the Buddhists talk about as being the unconditioned Nibbana, the ultimate release. So, now it's your turn. First, I'd like to hear from you, before you ask questions, what was that meditation like that we did? It was basically a meditation on letting go. Some of it you're familiar with from other time, just let go of tension in your shoulders. That's pretty innocent, right? Let go of your tension in your stomach. Let go of your thinking. But what was it like just to focus on it for 20 minutes? We just did basically letting go, letting go, letting go. What was that like? Yes?
I had a hard time staying awake.
That's one way of letting go. Oh, I hypnotize you. That's one of the dangers of guided meditations. There's all kinds of dangers in doing guided meditations. One is that people get lulled into it and get pulled away and fall asleep. And that's why it's very important in Buddhist practice to not just cultivate calm, but also cultivate energy. So you need to have both. Another danger of doing guided meditations is people are irritated by the voice. They get calm, you know, and suddenly his voice goes, you know, you know, leave me alone. But anyway, yes.
I was sometimes when I've done that, to let go, you can feel a sense of peace, but there was a little agitation that I was aware of, that I was trying to feel physical, where it was, and why the sense of pain was in my stomach. I didn't quite figure out why it was, and didn't quite go away, but it was interesting to notice.
Yeah, it's always valuable to notice these things. Yes?
I noticed that when I first started, I thought, well, I'm very calm and content. And then you would mention something like about the shoulders, and I'd check in with that and realize, oh, yeah, I have a lot of tension in my shoulders. And so it seemed like where I thought that I was already at a good spot, I kept feeling off more things and noticing more of the power of suggestion.
So I made you feel like you realize you were miserable by the end. Well, certainly, one of the things that happens in meditation practice, for example, is that we go deeper and deeper, and we realize, or more broadly, or fill in the pictures more, and realize areas we haven't been paying attention to. So like one thing that happens sometimes is people will discover, for example, the surface muscles of the shoulders might relax, and that feels good. But after a little while, they realize that deep inside, underneath that surface, is really tight and tense. And people say, oh, I'm going backwards. I'm getting more tense through meditating. They're not getting more tense. It's just that they've unraveled enough to see what they normally can't see because the surface muscles are hiding it. The same thing exists psychologically. If the mind is always busy and scattered and thinking about planning, you know, the shopping lists, you know, it's quite lovely to plan shopping lists. And it's, you know, certainly a health, you know, worst things you can do with your mind. But so you stop making the shopping lists, and for some people might be like, oh, I'm doing that because I'm so afraid, I'm nervous, and I'm kind of distracting myself. You know, so there's layers that we discover. In Buddhism, the Buddhist teaching is that if you are in some ways uncomfortable or stressed or agitated, you're better off knowing it than not knowing it. If you're tense, you're better off knowing that you're tense than being tense and not knowing it. The bad news about that is then you're aware that you're uncomfortable. So it's a little bit bad news, but it's actually good news. It's better to stay aware of these things. Otherwise, they kind of work behind off stage and affect us in ways that sometimes we wish they wouldn't affect us. Yes? In the back there.
I was able to become very physically relaxed, but what happened when I came upon a big lot of fear, huge fear, and I was so relaxed and going down, and going to peace, and all of a sudden this huge, big, ice lot of fear.
Great. Well, you know, that's to be expected, you know, as you go deep down. That's what I was talking about, this relaxing and finally see something deep down inside. So then we need to meet that with some wisdom and understanding. And that's where if you cultivated some ability to be an accepting awareness, wise attention, some stability of mind, some ability to be kind to yourself and forgiving, then it may be a little bit easier to confront that kind of fear. Or if you have other tools, you realize, wait a minute, I don't think I should look at this fear for a while. I think I'll pull back from it. It's too much right now. What I need to do is really develop some sense of well-being, something. And once I have that well-being, then maybe I can go back and face it. Did you have something or someone else? Saw a hand. No. Yes?
I was feeling really relaxed and kind of like to the point that I felt like I didn't feel my body at all. I was just feeling exploding. My mind was just floating into nothingness. But it was really short time. It was just for like maybe maximum of 5 seconds, and then I started feeling the body again, and I wanted to, the rest of it was just trying to go back to that feeling, but I was not getting there. It was just like a very short time, I got that extreme cannot describe the kind of feeling because it is very short.
Uh-huh. It's very beneficial to have that experience. And just, I would encourage you to be content for the 5 seconds you had it. It's a very common hindrance for meditators to try to recreate or make something happen again that they've had in the past. It's fine to kind of keep doing the practice and kind of hope that it might happen again, but it's really common to get attached to it and push for it and expect it and be disappointed if it's not happening. So be very careful, any kind of experience you might have, to not set it up in such a way that it's going to cause you to suffer. There's something, one very wise approach, I think, to kind of Buddhist life, Buddhist practice, is to have the assumption that whatever is happening is appropriate. Whatever is happening is the phase I need to be in right now. And so you might go very deep, and then you come out. Coming out is the appropriate phase to be in. And that's where you have to practice. And you practice with whatever is given you. And then over time, the practice deepens in its own way. But you don't need to be in charge of, you know, how deep or how shallow you are. Just meet this moment here as it is. Yes?
It's a very difficult time of being distracted by sounds.
Yes. Yes.
And I almost see it if there's a loud sound, it almost appears visually.
Uh-huh. There's a variety of things to say. I'll just say a few now, and maybe some other time we can talk about some others. But one is a change of understanding. And that is to not think of the sounds as abstractions anymore, but actually invite them and include them as part of the meditation. So like they're not outside coming in and bothering you, but they're actually just part of the field. You let them be there. And you might even actually meditate on them, just do hearing, whatever. And that's sometimes the wisest way, so you're not bothered by them. More often than not, being bothered by sounds is a symptom of some kind of attachment. It's like we're attached to, are my meditation, it needs to be really deep, and I'm getting calm, and you know, and so some sound comes off, you know. But if you're not attached to anything, the sound just goes right through. So experiment with that and see if that helps. If not, then we'll talk some more. Yes? talk to Allison. So now we can have questions or what I've said today. Yes?
You said you let go of a sense of identity or what you're clinging to as a sense of self. What does that actually letting go mean? You don't have that sense of yourself?
You're no longer clinging to it. You're no longer using it as a way of defining who you are, so that you can get more liked by people, for example, or feel safe. Or there's a kind of movement of the mind that where it kind of fixates on something, and locks in somehow. So some people, for example, choose their clothes more carefully than they choose their words. They choose their clothes very carefully because what they wear says something about who they are. And if they're seen in the wrong clothes, they're mortified. You know, and it just, you know, because somehow the mind is wrapped up around this issue of how they're seen. They want to be seen in a good way. They don't want to be rejected. They want to appear a certain way. They want to, you know, so letting go of being concerned about how other people think about you is a part of it. Just like, okay, so people can think what they think about me. I'm going to let go of it. Or I think I'm going to let go of thinking that I need to appear any particular way to show off, you know, who I am in some way. I think I'll stop showing off. You know, a lot of people show off. You can just let go of that.
Assuming your sense of identity is not something that's external, like it is who you are. Is the Buddhist goal also not to have that sense of who you are?
No, the point is the clinging to self. So you're welcome to be a woman. I think you are. You're welcome to be a woman. No one's going to take that identity away from you. Not, you know, not your choice, at least. But you don't have to cling to being a woman and all the things it means to be a woman. You don't have to hold on to it and cling to it and try to defend it at every possible juncture. And this is what it means to be a woman and in your culture or this culture or that culture. And, you know, just show up. and smile. It's enough. And so people cling to all kinds of things and they don't need to cling to, including who they are, who they actually are. And sometimes they cling to who they're not, but they want to be or think they are. Therese?
So how much does confidence play in this? Because it seems like when you have a lot of confidence in something or when you know and believe that you know, then you can like let go of, I don't know, in I guess the example would be in like dealing with others and in a situation, if you believe and you know that this is the right way and you stand for that, then you can kind of let go. Does that make sense?
It does make sense.
Like let go of what they think because
yeah.
You know that this is the right way. And so it seems like when you get rid of self-doubt, then you can let go.
Yes.
A lot.
Yes, I agree. So that's why this pyramid approach to practice is very important, because you need to develop the kind of strength sometimes that allows you to have let go of doubt, that gives you confidence, gives you understanding. And there's a lot of things that provide confidence. And there's certainly confidence in our ability. There's confidence that we're going to be okay if we know how to take care of ourselves if we do X. There's confidence in our values. There's confidence in, if I live an ethical life, if I follow the ethical thing here, I think then I really know that I'm safe. But if I start, lying here, I don't have much confidence in the power of lying, but I don't know what to do here, but at least I'll stay honest. And I have confidence in that. So there's a lot of things we can have confidence in. And it's an important quality to develop in any kind of mature life, I think. And taking the small and big steps to start developing confidence, I think is really worthwhile. The nice thing is that confidence comes from practice itself. Even if you're not explicitly developing confidence, just simply all the different things you can do in practice, simply developing meditation practice. As it develops a little bit, you develop a little bit more confidence as you go along.
So when you practice, if you're doing this through practice, is it very subtle? Because sometimes, I look up and I'm like, oh, I'm not doing that. And you don't even realize it, and then you have more confidence.
Yeah, sometimes it works that way. Sometimes it's... It sneaks up on us and we change in ways that we didn't see how it happened. And sometimes we see, oh, this is what I have to do, and we do it, and we're changed. And there's just a whole range in between.
But is that practice, or is it?
Sometimes the fruits of practice happens when we're not watching. Sometimes the apple drops when we're, at night and we're not out looking in the orchard. It does. I've seen many times, where I've been trying to focus on some issue in my life and working on it and dealing with it. And then I wake up one day and it's gone. And how'd that happen? Or I come back, I'm doing a retreat, I do sittings, I'm focusing on something, and I'm, working with it. And then I come back for the next sitting, it's gone. Where did it go? It's just gone. And I needed to do the work ahead of time. I needed to kind of be practicing with it. And that set the conditions for letting go, but I didn't actually see the moment of letting go. And I wasn't responsible for it, in a sense. It just, something came to maturity.
Is that how it's... successful?
That's one way.
Is that there's no struggles?
Yeah, to know there's no struggle is good. I mean, that's one way to know you're successful. One of the signs I had that my practice was working for me was when I could go through a residential retreat, like a 7-day retreat, and in the 7 days not get angry. Wow. And I realized, wow. I used to get so angry. I was sitting there. You're sitting there doing nothing, closing your eyes. Nothing's happening. Everybody's being nice to you and they're feeding you and everything. No one's asking you to work. And I'd be steamed up. Boy, would I be angry. But I can get through a 7-day retreat without getting angry. That was quite something. I mean, that was an accomplishment. You're not supposed to talk about your accomplishments. Too much. But anyway, I felt kind of, really made me happy. Wow, this is working. Yeah.
I want to hear maybe something about there's a missing piece here for me. If I encounter something really difficult,
and I tell myself, oh, I let go, you know, and I become aware that that just alone doesn't do it.
Right.
It's easy to go through that faith thing. But so in those times when I notice I am clinging or something, I've experienced some value, and I'm still interested in hearing more about really embracing the experience and like kind of going into it.
Yes. So the question is about letting go too quickly or in the wrong way, or trying to force it maybe. And instead of letting go, is there value in embracing the experience going into it? And I completely think that's the case. That's what mindfulness, in some sense, is a mindfulness itself is a practice of being, of embracing, being fully present for what's actually going on. So if you're angry, rather than letting go of your anger, it might be more useful to bring complete presence to it, and really see it and be with it and feel it. Give it permission to be there, and in the safe environment of your sitting, and then see what happens. You know, understand it. Because letting go is a big part of Buddhist practice. I've been practicing it a lot. I was pretty good at certain aspects of it in certain areas of my life, and I was relatively good at some point actually to let go of anger when it arose. And then a person told me that maybe I was too good, and that I should not let go of my anger at the first chance I had, but rather to hover with it, was the word that this person used. Don't linger with, let it stay there for a while. It was a little bit hard for me to do. I had to kind of learn this art of, and to know that it was there and not let it go right away, just let it be there. And the advantage of doing that was I got to learn to see it more clearly, the causes and conditions of it, you know, what prompted it, what the sense of self-identity that was related to it, and the whole ecology of it. If I let go too quickly, you don't understand. So there's wise and unwise ways of letting go. If in some things it's easy to let go of, you just do it. If someone cuts in front of you on the freeway, just let go and let them have it. Don't fight about it. It's not worth it. But if someone but some things you want to not let go of. But what you might want to let go of is acting on it. A variety of letting go, it's very important in Buddhist practice, is the practice of restraint. Now, restraint is a very unpopular word in the West, probably ever since the 1960s. We don't want to use it too much because people run away screaming. But restraint is a very important word in Buddhism. And it's letting go, for example, of acting on things, impulses that we might have, that would get us in trouble. So there's all kinds of things that we get in trouble with, you know, that they're not healthy, not good to do. And so we maybe can't let go of it, but we can restrain ourselves. So we're angry with someone and we want to say, you know, you jerk. You maybe can't get let go of your anger, but you can restrain yourself from saying you jerk. And then you just be fully, honestly present for what's happening inside of you and find a more useful way to hold that anger. So the idea of restraint is a form of letting go. And not to be undervalued, the importance of it. Yes?
I'm not sure if I'm going to say this, but it's kind of wanting to know how losing and letting go kind of goes to like helplessness and hope. You ever hope that you're clinging too much in this versus you give up, I let go, I give up, and then you may feel more
physical. So the question is what's the relationship between hope and hopelessness? And is hope a kind of a clinging? And when you let go, you're supposed to also let go of hope. Is right?
Yeah, I mean, here it can be seen as a positive thing.
Right.
Psychologically versus too much
of a positive. I think the answer is yes to both. I think rather than having an either-or kind of answer to your question, I think in some situations, it's completely reasonable to have hope. What people kind of colloquially mean hope. No one's going to sit down to meditate unless they have some hope that's going to make a difference in their life. Some people do, but generally it's reasonable to have some hope. To kind of some expectation, some very light expectation, hope is also really dangerous because it can be a lot of clinging and expectation as part of it. And so the art is to learn how to have some healthy sense of possibility and potential, and that maybe we can fulfill that potential. And what is some kind of hope that is fear-based or neurotically based, and so there are people who will say that the way to liberation is to give up all hope, and it's a very profound statement, but they don't really mean You know, you have to, you know, in context, you know, it's the right thing to say, but, you know, I hope that if you let go of all hope that you will become free. When I teach children about this kind of principles of clinging and non-clinging, I'll have a little bell. Maybe this one's too big, but to do it well. But I have a little bell, and I say, you know, if you hold the bell like this with an open hand, lightly, it makes a nice sound. But if you grasp the bell really firmly, so in letting go, it doesn't mean necessarily you have to let go of the things of the world or let go of certain things. We have to learn to hold them to make music out of them. And so the clinging is the problem, not what we're, you know, the thing necessarily itself. And so so sometimes there's a confusion in Buddhism between letting go of things and letting go of the clinging. But you know, if we can have an open hand, an open mind, and an open heart, no problem. So maybe the last one, and then I'll stay afterwards if people want to talk to me afterwards. But we should end now. So maybe the last one.
It's not really a question. It's just a statement about an interesting article that was Smithsonian this month about a group of scientists meeting with the Dalai Lama and various priests, Buddhist priests, to study what it is that makes them so happy. And I haven't read the results of the study.
Yeah, I read a little bit about these studies also, and the baseline for, you know, people have a baseline ability or potential to be happy, and that maybe they're kind of born with, that can be adjusted with practice. So there might be still swings up and down, but the baseline has changed, so you're more likely to be happier. Anyway, so I hope you all can be happier. I hope that this little introductory course, you know, gives you some idea. My hope is that it's maybe given you giving you some sense of what the spiritual life might be about, or Buddhist life might be about, and that inspires some of you, whether you want to be Buddhist or not, to maybe to undertake some of these and find some value in some of these ideas and concepts. We haven't talked a lot about practices, this was more of an overview of the basic ideas, fundamentals of Buddhist practice. There's other approaches to Buddhist practice. There's other ideas of what the Buddhist path are. And some of them are quite profound. I love them. They're great. More suited for some personalities than others. The one I've offered you this course is the earliest path as offered by the Buddha and along his lines. And I think it's also one of the safest ones because it's so systematic in creating the right pyramid, the right foundation, the right strengths, so that the deepest work can be done in a healthy way. So, I think it's one of the safest, more safer ways of doing all this. I don't know how many of you are new to IMC, came for this course, but if you are, you're quite welcome to come back here and practice with us any time or come for any of our activities. We're organized somewhat informally in the sense that the doors are just open for people to come in as they see fit. We don't ask anything of anybody, and we don't, you can come and you can go as you want. Come for years, come for a day, come for whatever. And we have this newsletter up on the desk there and table there, and you're welcome to come. We have a lot of different activities and a lot of different things. Some are more introductory in scope, and some hopefully will take people much further than just introductory level. And so hopefully the range of where people are in their spiritual maturity can be met here at IMC. So you might explore that or talk to people about what might be suited for you at different times. My hope also is that those of you who come here it makes you happy to support IMC. That IMC is completely supported by the donations of people who come and use the place. And it's part of our dedication to the spirit of generosity, to hold the teachings and hold the offerings of practice here in that spirit of generosity, where nothing's asked, but that we offer, we just offer generously, freely here. Come, take it if you like. And it makes me very happy to be able to teach in this kind of mode. It also means that the support for the center and for me, my livelihood, is completely comes from the donations that people make in that box by the door. So if it makes you happy, that's something to remember. And if it doesn't make you happy, then just walk right by. Yes?
Can you say a little about the relationship between the Sati Center and IMC?
Yes, there's some confusion about that. Sati Center for Buddhist Studies is a kind of a little more studies focused, kind of scholarly kind of focused maybe approach to studying Buddhism, Buddhist texts, Buddhist teachings, and all that. It's not so practice focused. IMC is more practice focused, and there's a place for both. And they're two different organizations, it's closely connected to IMC. Because I'm on the board of both in that sense. And usually Sati Center does all its activities at IMC. And so because of that, there's a strong association. Sometimes people confuse the two, but they're actually two different groups. We do have a Sunday service, though we prefer not to use the word service because we are a little bit allergic to the church language. And but for better or worse, who knows. And so the service kind of implies that. But yes, what we do is we have a meditation Sunday morning, and that's followed by a talk. We have two periods of meditation Sunday morning, and then we have a talk. And all those kind of information is in our newsletter. It's all listed there. So many thanks, and I enjoyed myself. And I think that we probably do this again in a year, this class. Thank you.